Welcome back to Coast AM, and we are talking about a great many things this Saturday night, and we are going to bring on our next guest, Mark Michaels and Patricia Johnson. Now, these two folks are experts in a relationship. They wrote a book called Partners in Passion, and they're going to talk about how we've been sold a bill of goods regarding relationships and how loneliness has turned into big business. And what is the truth behind all of that? Coming right up after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. Let's talk about the real law of attraction. Let's bring on our guest, Mark Michaels, Patricia Johnson, devoted married couple. Their approach combines traditional lineage-based tantra with the best complementary methods so that students can bring a heightened awareness to an expanded capacity for relationships and pleasure and in everyday life. Mark and Patricia, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us on.
Well, hey, it's my pleasure. You know, it's funny, when I was talking to Lisa about the idea of doing a segment regarding this, I thought to myself, it's not the usual type of thing, but you know, it's really important because we spend a lot of time on Coast talking about metaphysics and different, you know, lost civilizations. But the people that listen to this program are searching souls. These are people who are interested in a larger world, and they deserve to have a little attention put on them when it comes to a way in which they can rethink relationships, not only if they're already in one, but the best way to find one. Because I think, you know, we should pay attention to these things because it's really important for, you know, for the whole sort of holistic approach to being someone who is interested in more, who's interesting more than what we're told or led to believe. And that's what I want you guys, you know, to sort of start on, this idea of how loneliness has been turned into a big business.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at and especially the internet dating world, I mean, the annual revenue for internet dating right now is about $1.2 billion.
Wow!
So we're really talking about a massive industry,
and that increases with every click. Just keeping people returning, keeping people searching for perfection in some cases.
So the expectations are sort of all out of whack. People think, "Oh, I'm a Christian, I'll go to Christian Mingle. Oh, I'm a Persian, I'll go to Persian Signals." Or Have people been sort of formed into thinking how they should even approach getting into a relationship in a wrong way?
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea that you can just fill out a form and find somebody who's a good match for you is a little bit misguided, because there's so much in the human interaction that gets lost in that process.
It actually reduces human beings to a two-dimensional representation. And that, you know, we really have to delve into that three dimensions before you know if you're really going to have a fulfilling, encounter with one another.
Well, you guys have been at this for a long time. What started you in this sort of career of relationships and this whole sort of science of this interaction between couples?
Well, as you mentioned, our background is in Tantra, and we both had studied it sort of in books and things for a number of years, and we got together actually to practice.
And what you find is that, first of all, the practices are very powerful. We subsequently fell in love, got married, and actually managed to write 4 books together.
Wow.
But the practices are based in science, the science of physiology, and I think that's not known to a lot of people.
Well, what is the right approach? What should people be thinking about when they say to themselves, I'm actually looking to go on dates, and I'm actually looking to get into a relationship, or at least I'm open to it?
Well, I mean, although we're critical of internet dating, it's certainly one of the main ways that people are meeting now. And that's okay if you go into it with a lack of illusions about what you're going to get from it. And if you're prepared to really engage with the people that you meet and explore more deeply whether there's a real connection there. I just read a stat that says that the average time to marriage for people who meet online is 18.5 months, and the average time to marriage for people who don't meet online is 42 months. Now, 18.5 months may not seem like that short a time, but if you're caught up in the illusion and the belief that this person has been matched to you with an algorithm and therefore, you know, you really have a connection, what you haven't done is established a real relationship, and you haven't really discovered whether you're compatible for the long haul.
Should people even think that, hey, I want to try and find my soulmate? Or is that the wrong thing to think?
The myth of the soulmate is we feel very damaging.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that there is one person out there who is meant for you, and that if you find that person, everything will fall into place, you're setting yourself up for a big, big disappointment. The reality is that there are hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of potential partners out there for anyone. And what you want to do is find a person who's compatible enough, who works, who fits well enough with you. Someone recently said to us, well, soulmates aren't born, they're made.
Mutually, I like to say, you know, so mutuality, you really can discover that soulmate feeling with one another.
Mm. Well, a lot of coasties out there are probably thinking, well, okay, what is the right way to come at this? And I think you guys said something really interesting in the video that I was watching about how you should connect first and talk later. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much emphasis in American society and in, you know, it's really the influence of therapy that talking is the most important thing, and verbal expression is the way to get to connection with your partner.
So we say that while communication is important, talking is overrated. And if you're not feeling in harmony with your partner, you're not going to talk your way back into being out of conflict, for instance.
So what we recommend for people, and this is something that we really encourage for people who are in a relationship and for people who are single to do with themselves. In a relationship, what we do, the foundation for our practice is gazing into each other's eyes for a few minutes at a time.
As a matter of fact, we're doing it right now.
Right.
And for people who don't have a partner, they can gaze into their own eyes in the mirror and just have an attitude of honoring and appreciating themselves, because we spend so much time looking in the mirror and thinking, oh, you know, my hair's not right, or I might may have food in my teeth or something like that. We're critical. But if we can just start to appreciate ourselves, we then can be stronger for getting into a relationship.
The point also is that there's powerful information that's imparted through nonverbal communication. And people, if they rely on speaking too much, have lost that skill and that innate knowledge that we all should have.
Mm. I kind of took it as when people meet, especially if there's a dating wind in the air, they tend to just go ahead and start listing what they do and their siblings. And, you know, it's the sort of same old dialogue. And I guess, you know, that's one way to do it. But you guys came up with a better notion, is that to do something that you like to do that's part of who you are and find other people to share that with. And through that common experience, then you meet the person that you can have, you know, the continued conversation with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that we, you know, and this is going back to the internet, is something that we've really lost to a large extent in our society today. You know, there used to be a real strong sense of community, and people would join, you know, whether it was lodges or, you know, those kinds of things. There was a place for people to interact. And now I think we tend to sit in our homes and, you know, and type away at the keyboard and not really engage in face-to-face contact with other people.
And studies show that when people share adventures, their sense of bonding increases.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great way to maintain a sense of connection.
Yeah, it kind of speeds the whole process up. If you're in a noisy bar somewhere and you're talking about this, that, and the other, it's night and day than if you're on a, say, a kayaking trip or something like that.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. If you can manage it, if you're both in the same kayak, you're really...
Then you got to really be in harmony, because you got to be paddling, you know, well.
Should people wait until they find someone that gives them that spark, that sort of undeniable tingling sensation? Is that something that people should honor?
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say they should honor it. You know, sometimes that can be just pure chemistry, and it may not be the best foundation for a long-term relationship. It's certainly important to have that first 6 months to 2 years of being infatuated and really deeply into one another.
But I thought chemistry was good.
Yes, chemistry is good, and you can.
But alone, it's not enough.
Right. You want qualities in your partner, ability to be kind, to be trustworthy, reliable if they give their word, you know, basic things. You can be attracted to people who don't have those qualities.
And, you know, I mean, Patricia and I didn't, I mean, we didn't have like this intense, enormous, unrequited, you know, dramatic falling in love experience. We found this incredible kind of comfort and ease with one another. That didn't preclude us from connecting very deeply, from having aspects of chemistry. But if people are carried away by the chemistry and they don't, and they're blinded to the rest of it, that's really a prescription for trouble.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Sometimes people make bad decisions during that, you know, chemistry wash.
Hmm. Well, I mean, we do know that when there is that sort of feeling, that amorous feeling, it's a chemical response, really. It's kind of like, you know, taking some kind of drug.
It is, yeah. Absolutely.
Because your brain can make, your brain is one of the best, you know, pharmacies in nature.
Very true.
Right. And so it floods you with dopamine and stimulant sort of hormones, and you find you don't have to sleep as much. You may drop that extra 5 pounds you've been wanting to lose, and everything seems just at a height.
Well, people love that, though. People seem to chase that.
Well, that's actually the fact that people chase it is one of the problems, because inevitably that fades. It can't sustain itself at that level. It would probably kill you if it did.
Right. So as Mark says, it transforms into something more long-term and deepens into a richer connection. So.
But if you're seeking that kick, you know, that intensity, which a lot of people are, then you kind of end up going from person to person, and when that inevitably fades, you get disillusioned, and you think that, well, this person that I thought was the one, you know, they're not the person I thought they were. Well, they're not the person you thought they were, because you've just invented this ideal.
Right. They revealed themselves as being human and not your, you know, idealized soulmate.
Okay, so what should people do if they have this sort of gooey feeling and they're in that, you know, sort of the beginning of the relationship and all those things that come with it? How do they sort of take that and say, okay, right, well, now, what should I do to make sure this thing is for real?
I would recommend that they savor that spark, really, in that, you know, and really not seek to burn through that intense chemistry, but to savor it and watch it as it transforms and, you know, revel in that.
And also to be aware that that it will change, and to have just to step back a tiny bit and kind of observe the fact that you're in this intense state and enjoy it, but not allow yourself to be completely submerged by it.
Hmm. Well, how else does big business profit off of people's sort of, you know, manufactured sort of way of thinking about relationships and what they should be doing or saying or, you know, acting?
Well, I mean, the data mining aspect of the online dating services is something that doesn't get talked about very much, but the company that owns Match.com also owns OkCupid and a whole bunch of other companies, including Expedia, Ask.com.
About.com, other shopping,
Vimeo.
Shopping sites.
So you can be pretty sure that the information that you're providing to these services, including these very detailed questionnaires on your tastes and behaviors, is being circulated
and exploited to the biggest, you know, the biggest profit that these companies can have.
Hmm. Tailing ads to you and marketing to you, like that.
Yeah.
Huh.
And sort of, you know, profiling you as a consumer across the board.
Yeah.
So when you fill out something and you're the, what they sell to the online dater is this idea that the algorithm is going to match them up with a perfect mate, but really these all their that is just a marketing brand or way of spinning it, but really they're getting consumers to freely offer up very detailed information about themselves.
Hmm. Are you guys married?
We are.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a cheeky question. If you're so devoted, how come you have different last names?
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Interesting. I grew up in an era, even in third grade, I insisted on Ms. So,
I see. Yes. Well, look, hey, you know, it doesn't have any reflection on the depth of your commitment.
No, not at all. And yeah. The other thing I would say, you know, to respond even more specifically to that is that Patricia, when we met, was a very successful opera singer and had established a reputation in her career. And it would have been, we discussed possibly hyphenating the name, but decided that, you know, really, since she was established in that, it didn't make sense.
Mm. Now, of course, I was sort of, you know, kidding, but when couples do come together and they are in a relationship, how do you sort of draw the boundaries between the us and each other? Is it important to sort of maintain some of yourself? And is that something that often gets lost because people are too afraid to start to establish any type of independence?
I think so. I mean, I think what you have is kind of a one extreme or another where people, if they get into a kind of relationship rut, they're just roommates and they're not connected at all. On the other side of it, we have this idea that in, and this is a very modern concept, that a marriage should be a complete union of two people who get all of their needs and desires fulfilled in the context of the marriage.
Mm.
And it's really, really important. That actually is a relationship killer, because we all need our separate space and our realm that is our own.
So we like to distinguish between privacy and your private relationship with yourself. We encourage couples to have, or, you know, individuals to have their own private, you know, time. And we distinguish that difference between that and secrecy, which can be eroding to a relationship.
So if you feel like you've got to hide something from your partner, that's probably a bad sign. But
yeah.
If you have your own interests and your partner doesn't really want to participate in them or only peripherally is involved, there's really nothing wrong with that.
Hmm.
And people, you know, one of the reasons long-distance relationships often work well is because that's how they're set up. I mean, I'm not saying they all work well, but having the separate spheres can be really a way of keeping the relationship nourished. I mean, even within a more domestic arrangement, sometimes people find that sleeping separately, contrary to popular myth, really is a way of keeping them more connected.
Mm. Especially if your partner snores. Okay, let's hold it there. And when we come back, we're going to actually really dive into this even deeper. We're going to talk about the 10 big myths to having a good relationship. It's something that they write about. Their book is called Partners in Passion, and their website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And starting in the next hour, we're going to take your phone calls about this subject and anything else that we happen to dive into. So keep it right here. We're going to come back with more. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program, and we are taking phone calls in the next hour. And I hope that you will join in and tell us about some of your thoughts on all this. We're talking with Mark Michaels and Patricia Johnson, and they have written a book called Partners in Passion. And they have written other things, too. In fact, one of their other books won a USA Book News National Best Books Award in 2007 in the category of health. That one was called The Essence of Tantric Sexuality in 2006. So they are quite the experts on this. And we're talking about how loneliness has become a big business and how these dating sites are perhaps doing, well, a lot more with your information that you might want them to do. Coming right back after the break. Stay right there. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Mark Michaels and Patricia Johnson. And you know, before the break, we were talking about these online dating services, and it seems there's one for everybody. There's one for geeks. There's one for farmers. There's even one for people who are married and want to have an affair. It's really just, it's a runaway train, isn't it?
Oh, it's crazy. And if you throw into that, not just the dating sites, but the kind of the hookup apps and all of that stuff, it's incalculable.
$1 billion. Yeah.
I wonder what the projections are, because every one of these dating sites is now hooked up to an app and a phone and an iPad, and there's no stopping it. I mean, these things are probably going to double in the next 2 or 3 years.
I think, yeah, quite likely. It's definitely a growth industry, and there are new things coming online constantly.
Mm. So do you see this as sort of a danger or a threat to, I don't know, to society or to human culture? I mean, how far do you think this thing goes?
I would say yes, it is a danger, because when industry needs more data, and which these industries really rely on, they're going to propagate myths and things to keep people coming back again and again and submitting.
I mean, the other thing with the internet, and you know, any technology this is true of, but this is an experiment. We don't really know how it's going to all play out. And we've already surrendered most of our privacy because of the net. And I don't think anyone, you know, who uses the net is exempt from that. I mean, you can't be on Facebook without basically giving up a lot of your privacy.
Mm.
But beyond that, there's recent studies that are suggesting that people's reading, the brain function during reading has changed. Due to reading stuff online as opposed to reading it in print. Hmm. So we just don't know where it's all going to go. And in terms of relating to one another, I think that it does create a kind of disconnect. And it's very easy to rely on technology to communicate instead of actually engaging with your partner.
Being present.
Well, you know, it has worked, though. Some people have found love and marriage. Kids?
Statistics say about 20%.
Hmm. Well, the problem with the statistics is we don't really know, and the companies aren't very transparent about all of this stuff.
Hmm.
We don't really know how successful those relationships are.
What is the quality of them? How long-term were they?
So, I mean, the success stories, you know, it's like anything else. You can use success stories to drive ads, but if you're not providing really clear information about how the long-term outcomes are, you're just marketing. You're not really giving people something that they can sink their teeth into.
Yeah. Is this online dating an option, a good option for anybody? In other words, are there some people who, for whatever reason, don't get out, can't get out, can't meet people, whatever it is? Is it a viable option for certain people?
Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, what we're suggesting is not that people shouldn't use online dating. I mean, that train left the station a long time ago. But I think what we're advocating is that people should be more conscious and aware when they're using it and not have unrealistic expectations, not assume that just because there's an algorithm that the company says will match you with someone.
That it doesn't mean you don't then have to develop skill sets and mutuality and, you know, really be together to really have that. Then the relationship can take place.
Mm. Do you guys think that through the law of attraction, in this case using it almost literally, that people should just let things unfold naturally and let them meet their husband or wife at a supermarket or, you know, in a rainstorm or something like that? What do you tell people as far as what kind of mindset they should have toward, you know, the idea of getting into a relationship?
I would begin with not having expectations. I think that's the huge thing, the pitfall for people. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a partner, and they have to have these qualities, and they're not seeing the person in front of them, and they may be missing someone quite amazing.
Hmm.
And I would add to that, you know, and it's kind of a Buddhist-sounding idea, but to not be attached to a specific outcome when you meet someone. I mean, when Patricia and I got together, and, you know, it's personalizing something, I don't know that this would work for everyone, but neither one of us was really looking for a relationship or expecting to have, at that point in our lives, a long-term partner.
Yeah, marriage and a lifetime partner was not part of my life plan at all. So
if you're actively chasing a relationship, that's when it gets really easy to be seduced by the intensity of the emotion that you feel in the early stages.
Mm. This idea of expectation, I think, is really something to think about. Somebody said to me years ago that the cause of all stress is unrealistic material expectations. And that always stuck with me, because that guy who said it, who used to just dance in the park and sell jewelry on the sidewalk, was right. And it never left me, because I think that was a pearl of wisdom. So, yeah, why not apply that same idea to relationships?
Yeah, I mean, the emotional expectations are just as potentially stress-producing as materialistic ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now there's other things that come into it, realistically. When we take men or women, they're brought up in a family, and they're all their brothers and married. Other cousins are married, and, you know, and women might want to have children. And there's all these other pressures that people bring to the table. I mean, you just can't undo those.
No, you can't. But I think it's important for, and actually a listener sent us an email yesterday, and he said something that was really, I think, quite profound, which is that in our society, it's not okay to choose to be alone. And there's enormous pressure to be in a relationship.
And I think, I mean, people who are really happy alone and really enjoy their own company, I mean, they've got something really worn up on a lot of people who are trying to find happiness in another person.
Hmm. Do you think that men or women live longer if they're in relationships?
As far as I'm aware, the literature shows that, yes.
Hmm.
But there may be all kinds of reasons for that, which don't have that much to do with happiness. I mean, one of the key reasons I know is that men typically are very resistant to going to the doctor. So if they're in a marriage, it's often the woman who
I'm scheduling, you know, a dental appointment. I'm going to put you down too, you know, so we can go together, you know, that kind of thing. It just gets done.
And certainly in our relationship, which isn't kind of typical in a lot of ways, but that is one area where our gender roles are very much like the rest of society.
Huh. Well, there is that old expression, right? The woman makes the man, and there's got to be truth in that.
Yeah, and we would not just one way, though. We would hope that mutuality and that the collaboration and the adventure of being in a relationship together brings out the best in each other.
Mm. But men, I think especially, have a tendency, you know, to really benefit from someone else observing them and saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't eat 5 hot dogs and then you know, go to the football game and then tailgate for 3 hours and eat barbecue every day, and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, some men left to their own devices. You know, we definitely need the other side, the yin and the yang.
Well, I think people need that, because people, you know, I won't say need, because I do think that some people can be really content and, you know, successful and happy on their own. But a lot of people, if they don't have somebody to balance out their eccentricities, get really, really strange.
Do men and women balance each other? In other words, does the sort of duality have things that each other's don't have, and vice versa?
Well, actually, partners, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's gendered, but just having someone reflect back to you is very important.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think we're really, one of our myths is this idea that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. We really feel that that's a kind of counterproductive way of thinking. And to realize that, that men and women actually have a great deal in common in terms of what we want, and that every relationship, too, is different. So, you know, in our relationship, to use it again as an example, I'm much more from Venus than Patricia is in a lot of ways, in that I want, I'm upset about something, I want to talk.
He likes, yeah, long discussions and things. And I'm like, really? Can't we go out for a hike? Or, you know, wouldn't this, you know, I'm trying to, let's have a nice meal. I want that, fix it, you know?
So really, it's just about partners bringing what they both have to the relationship.
Yes. So
regardless of age or gender or anything.
Right. Not equal partners, but parity, we like to. You bring your talents to the table, and your partner brings their talents. And between the two of you comes this amazing potential. I mean, it becomes an exponential.
Synergistic effect.
Hmm. Tell us about this. I was watching you discuss this. I think it's an interesting point because everyone can relate to this. How the dialogue changes from when you're in the beginning of a relationship to how you end up talking to each other as that wears off. And when you're talking, it's kind of building a case rather than the kind of conversation you had early on.
Right. Well, this is a really, I mean, there's so much in that question. When you're first falling in love with someone, you're just hungry to know all about them. And you're also doing the eye gazing that we talked about earlier. And you're just, there may be some conflict, but it really is this intense energy that you bring to each other.
Right, and you're looking like the gaze of young lovers, you know, how they're sitting in silence and not saying a word, looking deeply into each other's eyes.
Now, what happens is as the relationship goes on and that new relationship energy starts to dissipate is that it's really easy for two things to happen. One is for you to start taking each other for granted. And the other is for you to start feeling more and more polarized and to have more and more conflict. And building a life together does inevitably involve conflict. So we suggest that people find ways to minimize the conflict that doesn't involve arguing and doesn't involve constant discussion.
So when you're talking, you're engaging the wrong part of your brain. That's not the part of your brain that you was active when you fell in love. And when you are falling in love, and if you use techniques to connect and encourage the right hemisphere, the falling in love hemisphere, you will continue to fall in love. I still get chills, like, so.
Because the left hemisphere, you know, it's the narrative part of the brain. It's when you're in a discussion, you get into this mindset, even if you're really trying to listen to your partner, you're building your case and you're thinking about how you're going to respond and how you're going to convince your partner that you're really right. So we want to short circuit that. And when there's an issue, you then turn to the issue as a team and address it by establishing a nonverbal connection first.
Right. So you work on it together and you're not backing up in opposite corners.
Ah. And so a gazing session before you talk about the problem, that can help?
Absolutely.
Like magic? Really?
You have to do the gazing practice as a practice so that you have the habit of it. But once you've developed the habit and you have a little bit of presence of mind and you feel yourself backing into a corner or building your case, we use this all the time. We call a timeout and we eye gaze.
In silence for 3 minutes and then take a breath and then sit touching close, you know, and start to address, tackle whatever issue.
It doesn't mean we don't fight. It doesn't mean we always remember to do this because we're human, but it's a tool that we have that works incredibly well.
And interestingly enough, couples that have conflicts that don't actually break the relationship, but stressors, and they work their way through it, actually have deeper bonds and longer-term relationships than people who report no conflicts in their relationship.
Mm. you know, people could probably use this in their other relationships with their family and their coworkers. I mean, they don't necessarily have to just use this in a romantic relationship.
No, and it's wonderful with children.
Mm.
Just to help them settle down and stuff, or if they're overwhelmed in an environment that, you know, you want them to just calm down, you can eye gaze with them. Really great.
Yeah.
Another piece, and it's a little bit off the couple's topic, but this comes from a traditional tantric and yogic practice called Tratak.
Mm.
And that means to gaze without blinking. And what it's designed to do is create one-pointed concentration. So you can do this in addition to gazing with your partner. You can do it focusing on a candle flame. It's one of the easiest ways to meditate. And I really believe that for people with attention deficit disorder, that it can be a profoundly helpful approach. So, I had ADD as a kid. I wish I had learned to meditate when I was 7.
Mm. I've heard of this, candle meditation.
Yeah.
It's simple. It sounds too simple to even people think it would work, but it's really quite powerful, isn't it?
Yes, especially if you do it prior to going to bed, it increases melatonin in the brain, and it leads to more restful sleep. And this has been studied.
Hmm. Okay, tell us a couple of the 10 big myths to having a good relationship.
Well, we hit one, which was the soulmate. The next one that we think is really a big one is the idea that they lived happily ever after. And there's kind of an interesting history to that tagline. In the fairy tales where it originated, happily ever after referred to either economic or social status. So you have Cinderella marrying the prince, or you have Snow White being restored to her proper station in society.
Now, in fairy tales, that phrase is usually followed by the end. So we don't think that's a great idea to try to employ in your everyday, your real relationships.
Yeah. And so in the fairy tale era, the idea that marriage was about was founded on romantic love was not present. That's a really modern idea, and happily ever after and romantic love really don't go together. Having a relationship involves effort, it involves attention, it involves care. And if you just think that you find the right person, you're going to, you know, fall into each other's arms and live happily ever after, and it's a very, very common belief. It's some upwards of 70% of people, I believe, have some form of sense of happily ever after.
Wow. Okay, talk about the expectation being out of whack. Okay, you have another one?
Yeah, that relationships are about getting your needs met.
Mm.
We touched on this topic a little bit earlier.
Now, I've heard that expression, being kicked around.
It's a very, very common expression.
Yeah.
And it really reflects, I think, something that's gone badly askew in our society. If you're looking to have your needs met by another person, you're imposing impossible expectations on them. We all have needs. We need food, shelter, and some measure of human contact.
So if you use that word, you're not meeting my needs, you're kind of inferring that your partner's depriving you of your very livelihood, your ability to live, rather than saying, I would desire this, or this is something I would like or want.
So if you reframe a need as something that you want or desire, and your partner then is in a position of saying, well, you know, I really don't think that I can provide that for you.
Mm.
They haven't let you down in a really fundamental way, and it gives you more options so that you can, you know, if you need to go out for a drive or something and your partner doesn't want to go, it's not like she's failed you. It's like you can go drive on your own.
Okay. Let's hold it right there. We'll come back with your phone calls and more of these myths that we are going to debunk about relationships. Hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Great to be with you on another Saturday night. And we'll have more with Mark Michaels, Patricia Johnson. Their website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Keep it right here. You're on Coast to Coast AM.